Sir, may I ask you a question?
What's on your mind, Lieutenant?
The Kobayashi Maru, sir.
Are you asking me if we're playing out that scenario now?
On the test, sir. Will you tell me what you did? I would really like to know.
Lieutenant, you are looking at the only Starfleet cadet who ever beat the no-win scenario.
How?
I reprogrammed the simulation so it was possible to rescue the ship.
What?
He cheated.
I changed the conditions of the test. Got a commendation for original thinking. I don't like to lose.
Then you never faced that situation. Face death.
I don't believe in the no-win scenario.
Welcome to another edition of Whom Pods Destroy, a Star Trek discussion podcast. My name is Terry DeFellin, and I am joined, as always, by Graham Sibley.
Hello.
And by Derek Mantle.
Hello.
We are going to be discussing no-win scenarios today. A phrase known to all Star Trek fans, largely associated with one movie, but in fact, something that we see in Star Trek throughout the franchise. I imagine our conversations will be largely restricted to the original series, because that's pretty much our bag, but it's not by any means, the concept is not restricted to the original series or its movies. There's examples in Next Gen, in DS9, all over the show, Voyager. So what we'll do is we'll start, I think, by just defining the no-win scenario, I think, as a situation where they are in a position where they don't appear to be able to get themselves out of a position where either they're in significant peril or they end up having to make significant sacrifices in order to get out of them.
Mm. The sort of damned if you do, damned if you don't situations.
So not necessarily one where you're going to die, but one where you're going to end up significantly losing out.
I mean, the thing with the no-win scenarios is actually... is a big thing in Star Trek because of the Kobayashi Maru.
Mm-hmm.
That sort of brings it out into our...
It gives it form, yeah, doesn't it?
It gives it
a shape. Rather than just being a concept of different ideas, yeah. Here you have a scenario which is perfectly tailored to be the no-win scenario. And it's a subject that is... It's a thread that goes through Star Trek 2, isn't it?
Mm.
Because they discuss it over and over. There's three major point times in the film where they actually discuss the scenario itself. And how Kirk says, you know, that Kirk is confronted with the idea that he's never actually faced the no-win scenario. And that's patently untrue, because he has in so many episodes.
Yes. It's interesting that when in that conversation between Kirk and James Kirk and David Marcus at the end of Star Trek II, when David Marcus says, "You never have faced death," I think, well... actually, I'm pretty certain he has on numerous occasions. He's had guns held at him. He's had knives held at him. He's had to make tough choices.
Yeah.
They
always come out laughing at the end.
They often come out laughing at the end. I'd like to talk a little bit about Star Trek 2, but maybe what we should do is just reflect on some of the episodes that we've covered on this podcast quite recently before we then go and maybe have a little chat about Star Trek 2. A Taste of Armageddon we talked about. For the listeners will probably be about a couple of months ago now. A clear no-win scenario there for the people of Emilia 7, I suppose.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, well, there certainly is one where they've made a choice in a no-win scenario and they're going with it and they're sticking with it throughout, and it's become a lifestyle for them to actually... not resolve the scenario, but just to actually stay within it, stay locked within it.
Well, stay within the mutually assured destruction sort of scenario for them.
Yeah. They've sanitized it, haven't they? They've over-sanitized it into something that on the outside seems utterly ridiculous, and that's what Kirk's reaction to it is. And as we discussed in the episode about whether or not it's actually a good idea to break it up, we don't know. We never see what the outcome of Kirk's intervention.
Very reckless of Kirk.
Maybe
that's the sort of thing that shows the sort of nature of the character of Kirk.
Yeah,
he is the hero. He goes in there. He doesn't. He doesn't believe in a no-win scenario because he's so bloody reckless anyway.
Yes. Maybe that's what David Marcus was kind of referring to. Yeah. Was his recklessness? And perhaps his unshakable confidence in his own decision making.
Shoot first, and then worry about the results.
And certainly, we never did find out. Not in canon, anyway. I understand that there's been some original fiction about Emilia 7, but I don't know what it is. I've not read it. So there's been some, I think, I did a Google search on Anand Seven's image while I was putting together our Taste of Armageddon podcast, and he turns up in a comic book somewhere. And I didn't have a look at it because I thought, well, I'll seek out that comic book at some point, maybe read that. It'd be interesting to see what happened there. So the no-win scenario is there's twofold, really, I suppose. Is it twofold in A Taste of Armageddon? Do we have the Armenians' no-win scenario? And is Kirk in that position? Does he face a no-win scenario or not?
I think he's blind to it there.
I think he is blind to it. I think he has got a no-win scenario. Well, he should recognise he's got a no-win scenario because he's either got groups of people who are in this, what if you want to call virtual war, but people are still dying, or you've got them embroiled in an actual war. And now he's gambling, of course, that won't happen.
Yes, yeah.
So he has no idea that they will because he's not even spoken to the other side.
No.
He's actually going into this completely blind and deciding, well, okay. But of course, they're in a situation where they're going to die if they just blindly go along with what the Armenians have decided for that will be their fate. And we don't actually know if this is actually the case. We don't even know who the other people are.
No, we never met the Vendekarians.
We don't even know the Vendekarians are going off to the disintegration chambers.
No, that's true.
The Vendekarians could be an entirely made-up thing just to keep the population down on Armenia.
Yes, I mean, you did allude to that,
yeah,
didn't you? That in fact it was more a question of managing public services and budgets rather than the end.
And maybe that's what Kirk thinks. Maybe Kirk thinks, well,
would have made an interesting alternative resolution to the plot, actually, if Kirk had actually uncovered that the whole thing was a cover-up and that Vendekar
It a much darker episode as well, doesn't it?
Yeah, very much.
I mean, what this comes down to, actually, that episode is actually not necessarily a no-win scenario for Kirk because the thing is that he gets out of it anyway, whatever happens.
You know? Yeah, it's so actually a win scenario because he's going to get killed, isn't he?
Yeah, I mean, the thing is with him is that there are numerous cases where he does go through a proper case where he has to make a decision which actually sacrifices someone.
Mm.
In our last episode, we actually looked on the case of Spock and his decision that he had to make to get out of a no-win scenario. He would have to sacrifice someone.
Yeah, this is a very much a real one in Galileo 7. Yeah. He actually comes up with more than one, doesn't he?
Yes.
Yeah.
And then I think maybe we should look at some of the cases where Kirk actually has to do that as well. And there are quite a few, as you said. Taste of Armageddon is a different one, but you've also got the Private Little War where he makes a decision that it was actually... Well, it's quite similar to... A Taste of Armageddon, in that you still have two sides, and
it's the balance of power story, isn't it?
And that
it could easily have been called Balance of Power. In fact, that episode, because it's about the principle of arming to war of superior forces arming to inferior forces or factions that are warring, in order to maintain. Stop the two superior forces from going to war in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
You've got the Federation involved with the hill people, and you've got the Klingons involved with the village people. I can't believe how many times we refer to the village people on this podcast. It's alarming, but perhaps in a way quite beautiful. ultimate thing is that those two at the end of that episode, those two factions are fighting a proxy war between the Federation and the Klingons. Again, we never find out whatever happens.
No, we don't. There's a lot of these unknowns that we've get in these episodes of Star Trek.
Yeah, actually. It's the anthology nature of it, and they never go back. I imagine that they probably do go back in original fiction, but in side canon, but not in they never revisit these things. But in fairness, that wasn't the point. The point was to illustrate the dangers of proxy wars in 1960s planet Earth.
We haven't learned a thing.
And we've not learned a single thing.
And actually in that one, I think that Kirk actually leaves in those, he ramps up the no-win scenario in that by actually arming the hill people.
Yeah.
the village people.
Yes, I mean, it's fair enough that the Klingons started it by arming the village people.
Well, did they provide them with their uniforms as well?
Yeah. Was there a navy?
You know, Indian chief.
Construction work.
Yeah. Motorcycle cop.
We will teach you better law enforcement and better construction techniques. And we will supply you with the necessary tools and uniforms in order to do these. They will look particularly effective for your young men. Yeah.
Okay, yes.
Yeah, so that's an interesting episode. We should do a private little war, I think.
We're going to have to.
Well, could we refer to it at least three times now?
Yes, with the music. Without,
yeah.
And we can do the shapes.
Yes, yeah, I'm happy to do all of those things,
yeah.
Particularly since the listeners won't see it.
I'm trying to... I mean, I know we've gone on the deviation there, but I'm trying to think of the knowing scenario in the original series where Kirk actually has to make a decision which does turn out completely wrong for him. I have actually thought of another one, episode we haven't actually looked at, but we will do at some point. And that's to do with the figure of Edith Keeler, I think.
Edith Keeler.
Yes. In
City on the Edge of Forever.
Because that is a proper knowing scenario for Kirk.
Again, you know, you've never faced death. It's, I don't know. I mean, that episode is killer, isn't it? I'm sure listeners know the story of the City on the Edge of Forever, in which, you know, in order to preserve his and everybody else's future, the woman he loves has to die. And
I've got it. I've got it. No, you see, he has faced it all loads of times. But remember when he fell in love with the robot? Went in his head. Spock just took it a bit too much.
Yes.
He just forgot all the
stuff.
He
forgot
all
everything.
All the stuff when everyone he loved died.
Why in Star Trek 2, the Rough Khan, he doesn't remember any of it.
No.
She must remember. You were devastated.
That robot you fell in love with, you remember?
Robot? No, I
can't
remember.
Me falling in love with a robot? That must have been third season. Yeah, it was, but you know.
Yeah, that was a stupid end to it. That was Requiem for Methuselah, and it was I thought that was pretty stupid. But by that point, third series was getting a little bit daft.
Yeah, he was on notice then, wasn't he?
Yeah, very much.
They were looking for work, weren't they?
Yeah. Galileo, maybe we should go back to Galileo 7 then and look at quickly Spock's choices and the difficulties that he faced. What can we learn about the way that he dealt with that, because in the end he just ends up sending up a flare, doesn't he? He manages to get anyone who's left up onto the shuttlecraft in orbit for a few minutes, and then he sends up the flare, ignites the fuel.
I think it's interesting because the way it's directed, it's made to look as if he only comes up with this idea when they're actually in orbit.
Yeah.
Or when they actually know that they've only got, 40 odd minutes to go or something like that, or not even that. And then you decide, all right, I'll do that. And when just as he like notices the switch, and then he comes up with the idea. And not having think about this is one plan that could actually work. This is actually because I think a lot of the things in Galileo 7 is very interesting because think about this is 3 years before Apollo 13 and the actual real life adventure that actually happened. When you know a ship is lost in space almost,
or in jeopardy,
and actually they have to come up with some quite sort of ingenious ideas to try and get themselves out of it. It's interesting that where art sort of like precedes what actually happens, and I think there isn't too much technical stuff going they don't sort of like find some crystals on the planet and try and jury rig something up there. They just say, oh, we'll just use the phasers, get that going on there. The recurring thing about Galileo 7 is the fact that every time Spock is given ostensibly a no-win scenario, he comes up with an answer for it. But because he knows he's going to lose both ways, so he takes the one where you lose the least.
Yes.
So
he takes the logical choice.
Yeah.
What he considers to be
exactly.
And alienates his crew while doing so.
Yeah, because they know. Well, the first decision he makes is the fact that three people are going to be left behind.
Yeah.
And when they say, we'll accept that, we'll draw lots. No, we won't draw lots. We'll actually leave the ones who have got least to offer.
Yeah. Shall we move on to another episode that we were doing fairly recently, and that is The Doomsday Machine. And this is, of course, is the story, the tragic demise of Matt Decker, who he found himself in a no-win situation, and he definitely didn't win. He lost his crew, lost his ship, more or less. And in the end, he lost his life, or he took his life, chose to take his life because of that. This, I think, is probably the most hardest example of being in a no-win scenario where you really do not win.
Well, Decker is the analogy for Kirk here. I mean, if this is what Kirk might have done, and if he made the bad, the wrong decisions, and so this is a sort of a warning for Kirk that if he makes if he has his no-win scenario, and he makes the wrong decision, it's all gone, So again, that puts the end to the thing about, like in Star Trek 2, that he's never, Kirk's never faced it, because he's seen it. We've seen it around, and he's had to make.
Never made that choice himself, obviously, because he's a recurring character, and we wouldn't have died. But you wonder whether or not he might have done that had the situation been reversed, had it been the Enterprise in that situation, and had he been rescued by the Constellation, would he, have taken a shuttlecraft and rammed it down the planet killer's throat?
I definitely think he probably would have.
You think so?
Because, I mean, the actual character of Kirk, he is the archetype hero. And somewhere along the line, he might have to make a sacrifice.
Yeah.
And he sacrificed Spock later on in the movies, he sacrificed the Enterprise, he sacrificed
He doesn't
David.
Sacrifice Spock, does he?
Well, no.
Spock makes that call himself.
Yeah, that's true.
Kirk is losing his shit on the bridge of the Enterprise when the Genesis device goes off, and he's utterly clueless. He doesn't know what he's doing.
But I think
all.
That's a really, really good analogy, because you look at Decker there and Kirk in Star Trek 2, and you can see what happens when you start losing it.
Yes.
At the top there.
And yeah, absolutely.
And there
are
characters there who have... Because Decker is even more tragic because he starts making the same mistake again, doesn't he? Yeah, and this is
yes, the definition of insanity. Yeah. So you keep doing the same things without effect,
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's
expecting
what he does.
Something different to happen.
In Star Trek 2, Spock is strong enough to go... Anything this guy does isn't going to work.
Well, Spock was already cocked up by giving Kirk command.
Handing Kirk command in the first place, and then he realizes that this is his Kobayashi Maru, and he refers to it, in that very moving scene at the end when he's dying. He realizes he's made a terrible mistake in a command decision in giving command to Kirk. Kirk is not experienced anymore; he's lost his edge. And he's too emotionally involved in Carol Marcus, and his boy's there, and he's just fallen to pieces. And so he says, "I'm now going to have to go down, and I'm going to have to make the ultimate sacrifice in order to rescue the situation." A similar situation that Decker finds himself in. He goes downstairs. He's being escorted back to sick bay, isn't he?
Yes,
and probably in that moment, he's gone, "I've messed this up royally. I've killed one ship. I've almost killed two. The only thing to do here is I've got to try and atone for this somehow." And then in the end actually comes up with the solution as to what to do. And that's why he's such a great and noble character, Matt Decker, because even under those circumstances, he still, in the end, is able to make the right calls, even though they are tragic for him personally.
Yes.
In a way, does that make him a better captain than Kirk?
You can't really tell just on that one sequence. I mean, we spoke about this during the podcast, didn't we? But when you get little glimpses of the fact that he is actually Kirk's equal, and he does if you see him on a normal day, you would not be able to distinguish between the two in the decision making
pressure situations, isn't it? That
but it's this one where he's had his whole crew annihilated and his ship has been crippled and he's lost it basically. He has nothing left. And in fact, he was going to make the most noble sacrifice. He was going to go down with his ship, wasn't he?
Yes.
He made sure he was the last person there.
That's right.
The whole thing about it, the fact that he almost resigned himself to death anyway.
Yeah, it was the massive switcheroo on him, wasn't it? Yeah, Fate played a switcheroo on him because he beamed those guys down there to save them, and he was going to stay. He was going to die.
Yeah,
and then the planet Claire decided to kill the planet rather than the starship.
And is there a way back from that? Couldn't anybody say, well, what other person who would have reacted in a different way? And maybe this was just the whole episode is Decker's protracted suicide bit.
Yes. Yeah, it is. Yeah, I mean, it is the story of the demise of Matt Decker. That is it. And faced with the no-win scenario, thinking he's got to take the logical and correct choice in the no-win scenario, and it backfires on him horribly. Mm. And truly is probably in all of it, it's the ultimate no-win scenario because, you know, okay, the planet killer is neutralized, but in terms of the consolation, all hands are lost. Not one person survives the whole experience, which is a genuine tragedy. The Kobayashi Maru, then, as a model, just talk a little bit about that. That it's obviously the big theme of Star Trek II, as we've just said, and
also in the Kelvin universe as well.
Yes, it turns up in the Kelvin universe as well, and on both instances, Kirk. Cheats, doesn't he? We see the cheating in Star Trek 09, and the nice reference to the apple while he's doing it as well. I don't know whether or not that's something that you know. When Kirk in Star Trek II: The Wrath of Khan is explaining what happened, he's eating an apple in the Genesis cave. When in 2009, Kirk is in the simulator actually performing the cheat, he's eating an apple. In a kind of I don't like to lose kind of way, which I thought was actually a quite nice touch, and I'm assuming is a direct homage to there. I mean, how do you think personally about the idea of presenting no win scenarios?
The introduction of the Kobayashi Maru, obviously in Star Trek II, is the movie starts itself. If you hadn't seen the movie first, you think that you're actually in. Situation with because if no one's actually seen it, it starts off with the majority of the regular crew
on the bridge,
but with someone else sitting in the captain's space, which is Commander Savick.
And
it does play out like a really nice little sequence there where they've got to make a decision, which is this
works better for us, of course, because the audience, because we don't know that they're in a simulation, whereas the protagonists do.
It sounds like a really tricky situation because you've got the ship, the Kobayashi Maru, that has hit a gravitic mine in the Romulan neutral zone.
It's in the Klingon neutral zone.
And obviously, you know, there are passengers on there and they're going down, and the people need to be saved.
Mm. So I think they may have also made up the Klingon neutral zone there and then as well.
Yes,
because
Romulan neutral zone was something that we were...
Because it was the Romulan neutral zone, but we'd never knew about a Klingon neutral zone.
Yeah,
and I reckon that the only reason that they came up with a Klingon neutral zone was because they were reusing the footage from motion picture of the Klingon Katingas.
Because
it's the same footage.
But let's face it, we know the Romulans had those as well, though.
So, yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, because they did say they were Klingons, didn't they?
Yeah.
But they could conceivably have got away with saying that they were Romulans, I suppose, if they wanted to. But
That aside.
Kirk's explained to Savick that how we deal with life is death is just as important as how we deal with life.
Yes.
And he obviously doesn't believe a word of it.
No.
Obviously not.
No.
I mean, I suppose that reflects on the decisions he makes, like in A Taste of Armageddon, where, you know, he just goes in first and asks questions later. Not even bother asking questions later.
No, you get back on the ship and then go on to the next adventure.
Bye.
Yeah, bye. Don't even bother leaving anybody behind.
It is the interesting one because obviously, but the start of it, Savick's solution is just go straight there, pick up the passengers and the survivors and get out of there.
Yeah,
going in breach of the treaty,
But bearing in mind that these are people and not treaties, and people are people, and that's what.
I wonder how many people take it and actually think, I'm not gonna break the treaty. So that's the purpose of the test, I suppose.
Yes.
To see what you do in that scenario.
Yeah.
Do you go into there? Do you break it?
Or, do you rescue those people and putting yourself at? I mean, putting yourself at risk, putting your lives, your crew at risk. Yeah. Yes, I think you probably do that because it's justifiable. Whether or not you then put the rest of the quadrant exist by threatening war, that is another bigger question.
Yeah,
which of course the commander then has to face is that the right thing to do?
Do you think that Kirk would actually do that? Place the just for like a situation? Is he?
Is he's got into neutral zone? No men.
Is he the hero that we think he is, or is he just really he's just big ego?
Yeah, as I think that sometimes it's difficult because you get an interpreter, because I think the way that Kirk is written and written by different scriptwriters depends on what kind of a character he is, and his character is not
and the tales that you're trying to tell. You've got a story first, and then you've got a hero that comes with a lot of definitions, but you have to try and fit it into the story that you want to tell.
When he enters the neutral zone, the Romulan neutral zone in Balance of Terror, he does it after much weighing up. He doesn't go in there lightly.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't like the idea of going in there lightly at all. Early first season Kirk is much more measured an individual. And goes in there thinking, I could be starting a war, and does it. And in no way is he the same cavalier Kirk who points a phaser at the Amini R7 computer and starts a real war, which
really does like stand away. This has always been my thought about the Kelvin universe, is about how maverick Kirk is, because he is. This whole definition, long-term definition of what Captain Kirk is, and early Kirk is not like that at all.
No, proper Kirk is nothing. Is very different. I mean, and I'm one of the
pre-Mitchell
many reasons.
One, that's what it is.
Yeah. Well, I mean, early Kirk is a stack of book with legs. He was a geek. He was bullied at Starfleet Academy. And Mitchell was the guy who looked after him.
Yeah.
Whereas as the show went on and he became a bit more of a Lothario, he's seen as being a bit more cocky, a bit more cavalier.
Well, he's a bit more like Mitchell in the end.
A bit more like Mitchell. Well,
this is what my hot take from that episode was. You see, Mitchell left a bit of this inside there.
That's very true. That was your hot take. The Kelvin Kirk, the JJ Kirk, is based upon that arrived at Kirk, and that he's a Lothario, he's a womanizer, he's super
maverick,
confident, arrogant.
But also, he's a troubled child,
and was indeed a troubled child. Which, in fairness, Prime Universe Kirk wasn't. He wasn't. He didn't have a difficult upbringing, and so I guess you can creatively justify the divergence of the two characters. But I think that's one of the reasons why sort of like hardcore Trekkies can get quite worked up by those JJ movies, because they don't like that interpretation of Kirk. They don't think that it's an honest interpretation of what the character is like. But getting back to the point in Balance of Terror, he weighs up his options and is left to make the decision. Nobody else can make it for him, and then he goes ahead and he does it. Now, as it happens, they come out unscathed, but that could easily have been a situation where he could have lost his own life, the life of his crew, and he could have plunged the Federation and the Romulans into a war with uncounted millions. He made that call, and it doesn't matter whether it was the right one. I guess the important thing is that you make the decision, and in this instance, it was a measured decision. Whereas I think that in a situation with the Kobayashi Maru, where there's other aspects at stake, he might well have thought, I can't leave those people in there. If the Balance of Terror had had the additional burden of a civilian ship in the neutral zone, knowing that there was a bird of prey, we're moving into fan fiction here now, but then what would he have done? Would he have done the situation differently? Would he have gone, I've got to go in
would
there?
Would he deliberated as long as he did?
Indeed, if it was a shuttlecraft, one of his own people.
Don't they say in the film that he tried it three times, the actual
Yeah. And was it three or two times, wasn't it?
It was
three times. You mean?
Yeah. And then it was only the third time that he actually succeeded.
Yeah, I wonder what he actually did. There is a book, and I've read it, but I can't remember what happens. There's a book called Kobayashi Maru.
I remember that one, yeah.
And I'm pretty certain that we do. There is a telling of how Kirk...
Mm. I wonder if in the first one he doesn't go in, and the second one he does go in.
That's it. And then basically...
And that's at that point that he decides that this is bullshit and decides to cheat.
Sure.
There was one other episode that strings to mind, and I can't remember what it is though, unfortunately, but I will very briefly mention it. It's a Next Gen episode.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a feeling it's probably seventh series Next Gen, and it's the B plot of a Next Gen episode in which Deanna Troi takes her commander training.
I remember that
one. Yes.
With Romulans in this one as well?
I don't know if the Romulans are in this one.
Well, this is the time that she started wearing the uniform.
Yes, well, it was after Chain of Command, so it might have been sort of mid-series six, season seven. But she has to, in the simulation, she can never get the simulation right.
Yeah, and she has a conversation with Riker.
And then Riker is over there, and then she ends up, I won't spoil it for you, because I mean, it's slightly later than that, and listeners may not have seen it.
Yeah.
But she comes up with the solution herself, and it's dark, and it requires an incredibly unpleasant and difficult choice to make. And I think that's a good example of that. We will have to do our Star Trek 2 discussion quite soon, I think.
And we'll have to do Balance of Terror as well.
And Balance of Terror and City on the Edge of Forever.
Yeah, because we all mentioned them in this one. And we're chomping at the bit with our hot takes on them.
We have, yeah. we've had a nice review of some recent episodes, and I think we've foreshadowed some future episodes that we'll be doing in future editions of this show, which is now coming to a close. We will finish now because I think we have football to watch. And beer to consume.
We do indeed.
It's Easter Saturday here, and we're off to celebrate by watching some beer and eating a bit more chocolate. Thanks, guys, very much for your contributions today.
Thank you.
Thank you very much to you, the listeners, for listening. The whompodsdestroy.com is the website, so you just go on there, and our Twitter, I was going to say Facebook, we don't got any of that. Yeah, Twitter, our podcast feed, our iTunes feed, all of that is on there. Favourable reviews and ratings are always welcome, but not obligatory, frankly. And until the next edition of Whom Pods Destroy, from myself, Jared O'Fellon, and from Derek Mantle and Graham Sibley, it's... Macho man, yeah. I've got to be a macho.